Chapter 14.
Mr. Nobusuke Togomi thought, "There is no answer, no understanding, even in the oracle, yet I must go on living day to day anyhow. I will go and find the small, live unseen at any rate, until some later time when..." In any case, he said goodbye to his wife and left his house. But today he did not go to the Nippon Times building as usual. What about relaxation? Drive to Golden Gate Park with its zoo and fish. Visit where things who cannot think nonetheless enjoy. Time. It is a long trip for the pedicab, and it gives me more time to perceive, if that can be said. But trees and zoo are not personal. I must clutch at human life. This had made me into a child, although that could be good. I could make it good. The pedicab driver pumped along Kearney Street toward downtown San Francisco. Ride cable car, Mr. Togomi thought suddenly. Happiness in clearest, almost tear-jerking voyage, object that should have vanished in 1900, but is oddly yet extant. He dismissed the pedicab, walked along the sidewalk toward the nearest cable tracks. Perhaps, he thought, I can never go back to the Nippon Times building, with its stink of death. My career over, but just as well. A replacement can be found by the Board of Trade Mission Activities. But Togomi still walks, exists, recalling every detail, so nothing is accomplished. In any case, the war, Operation Dandelion, will sweep us all away, no matter what we are doing at the time. Our enemy, alongside whom we fought in the last war, what good did it do us? We should have fought them, possibly, or permitted them to lose, assisted their enemies, the United States, Britain, Russia. Hopeless, wherever one looks. The oracle enigmatic. Perhaps it is withdrawn from the world of man in sorrow. The sages leaving. We have entered a moment when we are alone. We cannot get assistance as before. Well, Mr. Togomi thought, perhaps that too is good. Or can be made good. One must still try to find the way. He boarded the California Street cable car, rode all the way to the end of the line. He even hopped out and assisted in turning the cable car around on its wooden turntable. That, of all experiences in the city, had the most meaning for him, customarily. Now the effect languished. He felt the void even more acutely, due to vitiation here of all places. Naturally, he rode back. But a formality, he realized as he watched the streets, buildings, traffic pass in reverse of before. Near Stockton, he rose to get off. But at the stop, when he started to descend, the conductor hailed him.
"Your briefcase, sir."
"Thank you." He had left it on the cable car. Reaching up, he accepted it, then bowed as the cable car clanged into motion. Very valuable briefcase contents, he thought. Priceless Colt 44 collector's item carried within. Now kept within easy reach constantly, in case vengeful hooligans of SD should try to repay me as individual. One never knows. And yet, Mr. Togomi felt that this new procedure, despite all that had occurred, was neurotic. I should not yield to it, he told himself once again as he walked along carrying the briefcase. Compulsion, obsession, phobia. But he could not free himself. It in my grip, I in its, he thought. Have I then lost my delighted attitude? He asked himself. Is all instinct perverted from the memory of what I did? All collecting damaged, not merely attitude toward this one item, mainstay of my life, area, alas, where I dwelt with such relish. Hailing a pedicab, he directed the driver to Montgomery Street and Robert Children's shop. Let us find out. One thread left, connecting me with the voluntary. I possibly could manage my anxious proclivities by a ruse, trade the gun in on more historicity-sanctioned item. This gun, for me, has too much subjective history, all of the wrong kind. But that ends with me. No one else can experience it from the gun. Within my psyche only. Free myself, he decided with excitement. When the gun goes, it all leaves the cloud of the past, for it is not merely in my psyche. It is, as has always been said in the theory of historicity, within the gun as well. An equation between us. He reached the store. Where I have dealt so much, he observed as he paid the driver. Both business and private. Carrying the briefcase, he quickly entered. There, at the cash register, Mr. Children, polishing with cloth some artifact.
Mr. Tagomi,
Children said with a bow. Mr. Children, he too bowed.
What a surprise! I am overcome.
Children put down the object and cloth. Around the corner of the counter he came. Usual ritual, the greeting, etc. Yet Mr. Tagomi felt the man today somehow different, rather muted. An improvement, he decided. Always a trifle loud, shrill, skipping about with agitation. But this might well be a bad omen.
Mr. Children,
Mr. Tagomi said, placing his briefcase on the counter and unzipping it.
I wish to trade in an item bought several years ago. You do that, I recollect.
Yes, Mr. Children said. Depending on condition, for instance.
He watched alertly.
Colt 44 revolver,
Mr. Tagomi said. They were both silent, regarding the gun as it lay in its open teakwood box, with its carton of partly consumed ammunition. Shade colder by Mr. Children. Ah, Mr. Tagomi realized. Well, so be it.
You are not interested, Mr. Tagomi said.
No, sir,
Mr. Children said in a stiff voice.
I will not press it.
He did not feel any strength. I yield. Yin, the adaptive, receptive, holds sway in me, I fear.
Forgive me, Mr. Tagomi.
Mr. Tagomi bowed, replaced the gun, ammunition, box, and his briefcase. Destiny. I must keep this thing.
You seem quite disappointed,
Mr. Children said.
You notice.
He was perturbed. Had he let his inner world out for all to view? He shrugged. Certainly it was so.
Was there a special reason why you wanted to trade that item in?
Mr. Children said.
No,
he said, once more concealing his personal world, as should be. Mr. Children hesitated, then said,
I wonder if that did emanate from my store. I do not carry that item.
I am sure, Mr. Tagomi said. But it does not matter. I accept your decision. I am not offended.
Sir, Children said, allow me to show you what has come in. Are you free for a moment?
Mr. Tagomi felt within him the old stirring. Something of unusual interest?
Come, sir.
Children led the way across the store. Mr. Tagomi followed. Within a locked glass case, on trays of black velvet, lay small metal swirls, shapes that merely hinted rather than were. They gave Mr. Tagomi a queer feeling as he stooped to study.
I show these ruthlessly to each of my customers, Robert Children said. Sir, do you know what these are?
Jewelry, it appears,
Mr. Tagomi said, noticing a pin.
These are American-made. Yes, of course, but, sir, these are not the old.
Mr. Tagomi glanced up.
Sir, these are the new.
Robert Children's white, somewhat drab features were disturbed by passion.
This is the new life of my country, sir. The beginning in the form of tiny imperishable seeds, of beauty.
With due interest, Mr. Tagomi took time to examine in his own hands several of the pieces. Yes, there is something new which animates these, he decided. The law of Tao is borne out here. When yin lies everywhere, the first stirring of light is suddenly alive in the darkest depths. We are all familiar. We have seen it happen before, as I see it here now. And yet for me they are just scraps. I cannot become rapt as Mr. R. Children here. Unfortunately for both of us, but that is the case.
Quite lovely, he murmured, laying down the pieces.
Mr. Children said in a forceful voice,
Sir, it does not occur at once.
Pardon?
The new view in your heart.
You are converted, Mr. Tagomi said. I wish I could be. I am not.
He bowed.
Another time,
Mr. Children said, accompanying him to the entrance of the store. He made no move to display any alternative items Mr. Tagomi noticed.
Your certitude is in questionable taste, Mr. Tagomi said. It seems to press untowardly.
Mr. Children did not cringe.
Forgive me, he said, but I am correct. I sense accurately in these the contracted germ of the future.
So be it, Mr. Tagomi said. But your Anglo-Saxon fanaticism does not appeal to me. Nonetheless, he felt a certain renewal of hope, his own hope in himself. Good day, he bowed. I will see you again one of these days. We can perhaps examine your prophecy. Mr. Childen bowed, saying nothing. Carrying his briefcase with the Colt 44 within, Mr. Tagomi departed. I go out as I came in, he reflected, still seeking, still without what I need if I am to return to the world. What if I had bought one of those odd, indistinct items? Kept it, re-examined, contemplated. Would I have subsequently, through it, found my way back? I doubt it. Those are for him, not me. And yet, even if one person finds his way, that means there is a way, even if I personally fail to reach it. I envy him. Turning, Mr. Tagomi started back toward the store. There, in the doorway, stood Mr. Childen, regarding him. He had not gone back in. Sir, Mr. Tagomi said, I will buy one of those, whichever you select. I have no faith, but I am currently grasping at straws. He followed Mr. Childen through the store once more to the glass case. I do not believe. I will carry it about with me, looking at it at regular intervals. Once every other day, for instance. After 2 months, if I do not see...
You may return it for full credit, Mr. Childen said.
Thank you, Mr. Tagomi said. He felt better. Sometimes one must try anything, he decided. It is no disgrace. On the contrary, it is a sign of wisdom, of recognizing the situation.
This will calm you, Mr. Childen said.
He laid out a single small silver triangle ornamented with hollow drops, black beneath, bright and light-filled above.
Thank you, Mr. Tagomi said.
By pedicab, Mr. Tagomi journeyed to Portsmouth Square, a little open park on the slope above Kearney Street overlooking the police station. He seated himself on a bench in the sun. Pigeons walked along the paved paths in search of food. On other benches, shabby men read the newspaper or dozed. Here and there, others lay on the grass, nearly asleep. Bringing from his pocket the paper bag marked with the name of Mr. R. Childen's store, Mr. Tagomi sat holding the paper bag with both hands, warming himself. Then he opened the bag and lifted out his new possession for inspection in solitude, here in this little grass and path park of old men. He held the squiggle of silver. Reflection of the midday sun, like box-top cereal trinket, sent away acquired Jack Armstrong magnifying mirror. Or, he gazed down into it. Om, as the Brahmins say, shrunk spot in which all is captured, both, at least in hint, the size, the shape. He continued to inspect dutifully. Will it come, as Mr. R. Children prophesied? 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I sit as long as I can. Time, alas, will make us sell it short. What is it I hold, while there is still time? Forgive me, Mr. Tagomi thought in the direction of the squiggle. Pressure on us always to rise and act. Regretfully, he began to put the thing away in its bag. One final hopeful glance. He again scrutinized with all that he had. Like child, he told himself, imitate the innocence and faith. On seashore, pressing randomly found shell to head, hearing in its blabber the wisdom of the sea. This, with eye replacing ear. Enter me and inform what has been done, what it means, why. Compression of understanding into one finite squiggle. Asking too much, and so get nothing.
Listen, he said sotto voce to the squiggle. Sales warranty promised much.
If I shake it violently, like old recalcitrant watch, he did so, up and down, or like dice, in critical game, awaken the deity inside. Peradventure he sleepeth, or he is on a journey. Titillating heavy irony by Prophet Elijah. Or he is pursuing. Mr. Tagomi violently shook the silver squiggle up and down in his clenched fist once more. Call him louder. Again he scrutinized. You little thing, you are empty, he thought. Curse at it, he told himself. Frighten it.
"My patience is running out," he said sotto voce. "And what then? Fling you in the gutter? Breathe on it, shake it, breathe on it. Win me the game." He laughed. Addle-pated involvement, here in warm sunlight. Spectacle to whoever comes along, peeking about guiltily now. But no one saw. Old men snoozing. Measure of relief there. Tried everything, he realized. Pleaded, contemplated, threatened, philosophized at length. What else can be done? Could I but stay here? It is denied me. Opportunity will perhaps occur again. And yet, as W. S. Gilbert says, such an opportunity will not occur again. Is that so? I feel it to be so. When I was a child, I thought as a child. But now I have put away childish things. Now I must seek in other realms. I must keep after this object in new ways. I must be scientific, exhaust by logical analysis every entree, systematically, in classic Aristotelian laboratory manner. He put his finger in his right ear to shut off traffic and all other distracting noises. Then he tightly held the silver triangle, shell-wise, to his left ear. No sound. No roar of simulated ocean. In actuality, interior blood motion noises. Not even that. Then what other sense might apprehend mystery? Hearing of no use, evidently. Mr. Degomi shut his eyes and began fingering every bit of surface on the item. Not touch. His fingers told him nothing. Smell. He put the silver close to his nose and inhaled. Metallic faint odor, but it conveyed no meaning. Taste. Opening his mouth, he sneaked the silver triangle within, popped it in like a cracker, but of course refrained from chewing. No meaning, only bitter, hard, cold thing. He again held it in his palm. Back at last to seeing. Highest ranking of the senses, Greek scale of priority. He turned the silver triangle each and every way. He viewed it from every extra-rem standpoint. "What do I see?" he asked himself. "Due to long, patient, painstaking study, what is clue of truth that confronts me in this object?" "Yield," he told the silver triangle. "Cough up arcane secret." "Like frog pulled from depths," he thought. "Clutched in fist, given command to declare what lies below in the watery abyss." But here the frog does not even mock. It strangles silently, becomes stone or clay or mineral, inert, passes back to the rigid substance familiar in its tomb world. Metal is from the earth, he thought as he scrutinized. From below, from that realm which is the lowest, the most dense. Land of trolls and caves, dank, always dark. Yin world, in its most melancholy aspect. World of corpses, decay and collapse. Of feces, all that has died, slipping and disintegrating back down layer by layer. The demonic world of the immutable, the time that was. And yet, in the sunlight, the silver triangle glittered. It reflected light. Fire, Mr. Tagomi thought. Not dank or dark object at all. Not heavy, weary, but pulsing with life. The high realm, aspect of Yang, empyrean, ethereal, as befits work of art. Yes, that is artist's job— takes mineral rock from dark, silent earth, transforms it into shining, light-reflecting form from sky, has brought the dead to life. Corpse turned to fiery display. The past has yielded to the future. "Which are you?" he asked the silver squiggle. "Dark, dead yin or brilliant, living yang?" In his palm the silver squiggle danced and blinded him. He squinted, seeing now only the play of fire. "Body of yin, soul of yang, metal and fire unified. The outer and inner, microcosmos in my palm. What is the space which this speaks of? Vertical ascent, to heaven. Of time? Into the light world of the mutable. Yes, this thing has disgorged its spirit, light, and my attention is fixed, I can't look away. Spellbound by mesmerizing shimmering surface which I can no longer control, no longer free to dismiss. Now talk to me, he told it. Now that you have snared me, I want to hear your voice issuing from the blinding clear white light, such as we expect to see only in the Bardo-Thodol afterlife existence. But I do not have to wait for death, for the decomposition of my animus as it wanders in search of a new womb. All the terrifying and beneficent deities, we will bypass them, and the smoky lights as well, and the couples in coitus. everything except this light. I am ready to face without terror. Notice I do not blench. I feel the hot winds of karma driving me. Nevertheless, I remain here. My training was correct. I must not shrink from the clear white light, for if I do, I will once more re-enter the cycle of birth and death, never knowing freedom, never obtaining release. The veil of Maya will fall once more if I... The light disappeared. He held the dull silver triangle only. Shadow had cut off the sun. Mr. Tagomi glanced up. Tall, blue-suited policeman standing by his bench, smiling.
"Eh?"
Mr. Tagomi said, startled.
"I was just watching you work that puzzle."
The policeman started on along the path.
"Puzzle?" Mr. Tagomi echoed.
"Not a puzzle."
"Isn't that one of those little puzzles you have to take apart? My kid has a whole lot of them. Some are hard."
The policeman passed on. Mr. Tagomi thought, "Spoiled. My chance at Nirvana, gone. Interrupted by that white barbarian Neanderthal yank, that subhuman supposing I worked a child's puerile toy." Rising from the bench, he took a few steps unsteadily. "Must calm down. Dreadful, low-class, jingoistic, racist invectives, unworthy of me. Incredible, unredemptive passions clashing in my breast." He made his way through the park. "Keep moving," he told himself. "Catharsis in motion." He reached periphery of park. Sidewalk, Kearney Street. Heavy, noisy traffic. Mr. Tagomi halted at the curb. No pedicabs. He walked along the sidewalk instead. He joined the crowd. Never can get one when you need it.
God, what is that?
He stopped, gaped at hideous, misshapen thing on skyline, like nightmare of roller coaster suspended, blotting out view. Enormous construction of metal and cement in air. Mr. Tagomi turned to a passerby, a thin man in rumpled suit.
"What is that?"
he demanded, pointing. The man grinned.
"Awful, ain't it? That's the Embarcadero Freeway. A lot of people think it stinks up the view."
"I never saw it before," Mr. Tagomi said.
"You're lucky,"
the man said, and went on. Mad dream, Mr. Tagomi thought. Must wake up. Where are the pedicabs today? He began to walk faster. Whole vista has dull, smoky, tomb-world cast. Smell of burning. Dim gray buildings, sidewalk. Peculiar harsh tempo in people, and still no pedicabs.
"Cab!"
he shouted, as he hurried along. Hopeless, only cars and buses. Cars like brutal big crushers, all unfamiliar in shape. He avoided seeing them, kept his eyes straight ahead. Distortion of my optic perception of particularly sinister nature, a disturbance affecting my sense of space, horizon twisted out of line, like lethal astigmatism striking without warning. Must obtain respite. Ahead, a dingy lunch counter. Only whites within, all supping. Mr. Tagomi pushed open the wooden swinging doors. Smell of coffee. Grotesque jukebox in corner blaring out. He winced and made his way to the counter. All stools taken by whites. Mr. Tagomi exclaimed. Several whites looked up. But none departed their places. None yielded their stools to him. They merely resumed supping.
"I insist,"
Mr. Tagomi said loudly to the first white. He shouted in the man's ear. The man put down his coffee mug and said,
"Watch it, Tojo."
Mr. Tagomi looked to the other whites. All watched with hostile expressions. And none stirred. Bardo-Thodol existence, Mr. Tagomi thought. Hot winds blowing me who knows where. This is vision of what? Can the animus endure this? Yes, the Book of the Dead prepares us. After death we seem to glimpse others, but all appear hostile to us. One stands isolated, unsuccored wherever one turns. The terrible journey, and always the realms of suffering, rebirth, ready to receive the fleeing, demoralized spirit. The delusions. He hurried from the lunch counter. The door swung together behind him. He stood once more on the sidewalk.
Where am I?
Out of my world, my space and time. The silver triangle disoriented me. I broke from my moorings and hence stand on nothing. So much for my endeavor. Lesson to me forever. One seeks to contravene one's perceptions. Why? So that one can wander utterly lost without signposts or guide? This hypnagogic condition, attention faculty diminished so that twilight state obtains.
world seen merely in symbolic archetypal aspect, totally confused with unconscious material. Typical of hypnosis-induced somnambulism. Must stop this dreadful gliding among shadows, refocus concentration, and thereby restore ego center. He felt in his pockets for the silver triangle. Gone. Left the thing on the bench in the park with briefcase. Catastrophe. Crouching, he ran back up the sidewalk to the park. Dozing bums eyed him in surprise as he hurried up the path. There, the bench. And leaning against it still, his briefcase. No sign of the silver triangle. He hunted. Yes, fallen through to grass, it lay partly hidden, where he had hurled it in rage. He reseated himself, panting for breath. Focus on silver triangle once more, he told himself when he could breathe. Scrutinize it forcefully and count. At 10, utter startling noise. Evach, for instance. Idiotic daydreaming of fugal type, he thought. Emulation of more noxious aspects of adolescence, rather than the clear-headed, pristine innocence of authentic childhood. Just what I deserve, anyhow. All my own fault. No intention by Mr. R. Children or artisans. My own greed to blame. One cannot compel understanding to come. He counted slowly, aloud, and then jumped to his feet.
Goddamn stupidity! He said sharply.
Mists cleared? He peeped about. Diffusion subsided, in all probability. Now one appreciates St. Paul's incisive word choice, seen through glass darkly, not a metaphor, but astute reference to optical distortion. We really do see astigmatically, in fundamental sense, our space and our time creations of our own psyche, and when these momentarily falter, like acute disturbance of middle ear. Occasionally we list eccentrically, all sense of balance gone. He reseated himself, put the silver squiggle away in his coat pocket, sat holding his briefcase on his lap. What I must do now, he told himself, is go and see if that malignant construction, what did the man call it? Embarcadero Freeway? If it is still palpable. But he felt afraid to. And yet, he thought, I can't merely sit here. I have loads to lift, as old U.S. folk expression has it. Jobs to be done. Dilemma. Two small Chinese boys came scampering noisily along the path. A flock of pigeons fluttered up. The boys paused.
Mr. Tagomi called.
You, young fellows.
He dug into his pocket.
Come here.
The two boys guardedly approached.
Here's a dime.
Mr. Tagomi tossed them a dime. The boys scrambled for it.
Go down to Kearney Street and see if there are any pedicabs. Come back and tell me.
Will you give us another dime?
One of the boys said.
When we get back?
Yes, Mr. Tagomi said.
But tell me the truth.
The boys raced off along the path. If there are not, Mr. Tagomi thought, I would be well advised to retire to secluded place and kill myself. He clutched his briefcase. Still have the weapon. No difficulty there. The boys came tearing back.
Six!
One of them yelled.
I counted six.
I counted five.
The other boy gasped.
Mr. Tagomi said, You're sure they were pedicabs? You distinctly saw the drivers pedaling?
Yes, sir,
the boys said together. He gave each boy a dime. They thanked him and ran off. Back to office and job, Mr. Tagomi thought. He rose to his feet, gripping the handle of his briefcase. Duty calls. Customary day once again. Once more he walked down the path to the sidewalk.
Cab, he called.
From the traffic a pedicab appeared. The driver came to a halt at the curb, his dark face glistening, chest heaving.
Yaza!
Take me to the Nippon Times building,
Mr. Tagomi ordered. He ascended to the seat and made himself comfortable. Pedaling furiously, the pedicab driver moved out among the other cabs and cars. It was slightly before noon when Mr. Tagomi reached the Nippon Times building. From the main lobby, he instructed a switchboard operator to connect him with Mr. Ramsey upstairs.
Tagomi here, he said when the connection was complete. Good morning, sir. I am relieved. Not seeing you, I apprehensively telephoned your home at 10 o'clock, but your wife said that you had left for unknown parts.
Mr. Tagomi said,
Has the mess been cleared?
No sign remains.
Beyond dispute?
My word, sir.
Satisfied, Mr. Tagomi hung up and went to take the elevator. Upstairs, as he entered his office, he permitted himself a momentary search, rim of his vision. No sign, as was promised. He felt relief. No one would know who hadn't seen. Historicity bonded into nylon tile of floor. Mr. Ramsey met him inside.
"Your courage is topic for panegyric down below at the Times," he began. "An article depicting..."
Making out Mr. Tagomi's expression, he broke off.
"Answer regarding pressing matters," Mr. Tagomi said. "General Tadeki, that is, quantum Mr. Yotabi. On carefully obscure flight back to Tokyo, red herring strewn hither and yon."
Mr. Ramsey crossed his fingers, symbolizing their hope.
"Please recount regarding Mr. Baines."
"I don't know. During your absence he appeared briefly, even furtively, but did not talk."
Mr. Ramsey hesitated.
"Possibly he returned to Germany."
"Far better for him to go to the home islands," Mr. Tagomi said, mostly to himself.
In any case, it was with the old general that their concern of important nature lay. "And it is beyond my scope," Mr. Tagomi thought. "Myself, my office. They made use of me here, which naturally was proper and good. I was their, what is it deemed? Their cover. I am a mask, concealing the real. Behind me, hidden, actuality goes on, safe from prying eyes." Odd, he thought. Vital sometimes to be merely cardboard front, like carton. Bit of Satori there, if I could lay hold of it. Purpose and overall scheme of illusion, could we but fathom. Law of economy, nothing is waste, even the unreal. What a sublimity in the process. Miss Afrikian appeared, her manner agitated.
"Mr. Tagomi, the switchboard sent me."
"Be cool, miss," Mr. Tagomi said. "The current of time urges us along," he thought.
"Sir, the German consul is here. He wants to speak to you."
She glanced from him to Mr. Ramsey and back, her face unnaturally pale.
"They say he was here in the building earlier, too, but they knew you—"
Mr. Tagomi waved her silent.
"Mr. Ramsey, please recollect for me the consul's name."
"Freiherr Hugo Rice, sir."
"Now I recall."
Well, he thought, evidently Mr. Childen did me a favor after all, by declining to re-accept the gun. Carrying his briefcase, he left his office and walked out into the corridor. There stood a slightly built, well-dressed white, close-cut orange hair, shiny black European leather Oxfords, erect posture, and effeminate ivory cigarette holder. No doubt he.
"Herr H. Rice," Mr. Tagomi said. The German bowed.
"Has been fact," Mr. Tagomi said, "that you and I have in times past conducted business by mail, phone, etc., but never until now saw face to face."
"An honor," Herr Rice said, advancing toward him, "even considering the irritating, distressing circumstances."
"I wonder,"
Mr. Tagomi said.
The German raised an eyebrow.
"Excuse me," Tagomi said. "My cognition hazed over due to those indicated circumstances. Frailty of clay-made substance, one might conclude."
"Awful," Herr Rice said. He shook his head.
"When I first—" Mr. Tagomi said. "Before you begin litany, let me speak."
"Certainly."
"I personally shot your two SD men," Mr. Tagomi said. "The San Francisco Police Department summoned me," Herr Rice said, blowing offensive-smelling cigarette smoke around them both. "For hours I've been down at the Kearney Street station and at the morgue, and then I've been reading over the accounts your people gave to the investigating police inspectors. Absolutely dreadful, this, from start to finish."
Mr. Tagomi said nothing.
"However," Herr Rice continued, "the contention that the hoodlums are connected with the Reich hasn't been established. As far as I'm concerned, the whole matter is insane. I'm sure you acted absolutely properly, Mr. Tagomi."
"Tagomi."
"My hand,"
the consul said, extending his hand.
"Let's shake a gentleman's agreement to drop this. It's unworthy, especially in these critical times, when any stupid publicity might inflame the mob mind, to the detriment of both our nation's interests."
"Guilt, nonetheless, is on my soul," Mr. Tagomi said. "Blood, Herr Rice, can never be eradicated like ink."
The consul seemed nonplussed. "I crave forgiveness," Mr. Tagomi said. "You cannot give it to me, though. Possibly no one can. I intend to read famous diary by Massachusetts ancient divine Goodman C. Mather. Deals, I am told, with guilt and hellfire, et al."
The consul smoked his cigarette rapidly, intently studying Mr. Tagomi.
"Allow me to notify you," Mr. Tagomi said, "that your nation is about to descend into greater vileness than ever. You know the hexagram, the abyss? Speaking as a private person, not as representative of Japan officialdom, I declare, heart sick with horror. Bloodbath coming beyond all compare. Yet even now you strive for some slight egotistic gain or goal. Put one over on rival faction, the SD, eh? While you get Herr B. Kreutz van Meer in hot water."
He could not go on. His chest had become constricted, like childhood, he thought, asthma when angry at the old lady.
"I am suffering," he told Herr Reiss, who had put out his cigarette now, "of malady growing these long years, but which entered virulent from the day I heard, helplessly, your leader's escapades recited. Anyhow, therapeutic possibility, nil. For you too, sir. In language of Goodman C. Mather, if properly recalled, repent."
The German consul said huskily,
"Properly recalled."
He nodded, lit a new cigarette with trembling fingers. From the office, Mr. Ramsey appeared. He carried a sheaf of forms and papers. To Mr. Tagomi, who stood silent, trying to get an unconstricted breath, he said,
"While he's here, routine matter having to do with his functionality."
Reflexively, Mr. Tagomi took the forms held out. He glanced at them. Form 2050, request by Reich through representative in PSA, Consul Freiherr of Hugo Reiss, for remand of felon now in custody of San Francisco Police Department. Jew, named Frank Fink, citizen, according to Reich's law, of Germany, retroactive June 1960, for protective custody under Reich's law, etc. He scanned it over once.
"Pen, sir,"
Mr. Ramsey said.
"That concludes business with German government this date."
He eyed the consul with distaste as he held the pen to Mr. Tagomi.
"No,"
Mr. Tagomi said. He returned the 2050 form to Mr. Ramsey. Then he grabbed it back, scribbled on the bottom, "Release, ranking trade mission, SF authority, V-Day Military Protocol, 1947. Tagomi." He handed one carbon to the German consul, the others to Mr. Ramsey along with the original.
"Good day, Herr Reiss."
He bowed. The German consul bowed, too. He scarcely bothered to look at the paper.
"Please conduct future business through immediate machinery such as mail, telephone, cable," Mr. Tagomi said. "Not personally."
The consul said,
"You're holding me responsible for general conditions beyond my jurisdiction." "Chicken shit,"
Mr. Tagomi said.
"I say that to that. This is not the way civilized individuals conduct business," the consul said. "You're making this all bitter and vindictive. There ought to be mere formality with no personality embroiled."
He threw his cigarette onto the corridor floor, then turned and strode off.
"Take foul, stinking cigarette along,"
Mr. Tagomi said weakly, but the consul had turned the corner.
"Childish conduct by self,"
Mr. Tagomi said to Mr. Ramsey.
"You witnessed repellent childish conduct."
He made his way unsteadily back into his office. No breath at all now. A pain flowed down his left arm, and at the same time a great open palm of hand flattened and squashed his ribs. "Oof," he said. Before him, no carpet, but merely shower of sparks, rising, red. "Help, Mr. Ramsey," he said, but no sound. "Please," he reached out, stumbled, nothing to catch even. As he fell, he clutched within his coat the silver triangle thing Mr. Children had urged on him. Did not save me, he thought, did not help. All that endeavor. His body struck the floor, hands and knees, gasping, the carpet at his nose, Mr. Ramsey now rushing about, bleating. "Keep equipoise," Mr. Tagomi thought.
"I'm having a small heart attack,"
Mr. Tagomi managed to say. Several persons were involved now, transporting him to couch.
Be calm, sir,
one was telling him.
Notify wife, please, Mr. Tagomi said.
Presently he heard ambulance noises, wailing from street, plus much bustle, people coming and going. A blanket was put over him, up to his armpits, tie removed, collar loosened.
Better now, Mr. Tagomi said.
He lay comfortably, not trying to stir. Career over anyhow, he decided. German consul no doubt raise row higher up, complain about incivility. Right to so complain, perhaps. Anyhow, work done. As far as I can, my part. Rest up to Tokyo and factions in Germany. Struggle beyond me in any case. I thought it was merely plastics, he thought. Important mold salesman. Oracle guessed and gave clue, but... Remove his shirt, a voice stated. No doubt building's physician. Highly authoritative tone. Mr. Tagomi smiled. Tone is everything. Could this, Mr. Tagomi wondered, be the answer? Mystery of body organism, its own knowledge? Time to quit, or time partially to quit. A purpose which I must acquiesce to. What had the oracle last said to his query in the office as those two lay dying or dead? 61. Inner truth. Pigs and fishes are least intelligent of all, hard to convince. It is I. The book means me. I will never fully understand. That is the nature of such creatures. Or is this inner truth now, this that is happening to me? I will wait. I will see which it is. Perhaps it is both. That evening, just after the dinner meal, a police officer came to Frank Frink's cell, unlocked the door, and told him to go pick up his possessions at the desk. Shortly he found himself out on the sidewalk before the Kearney Street station, among the many passers-by hurrying along, the buses and honking cars and yelling pedicab drivers. The air was cold. Long shadows lay before each building. Frank Frink stood a moment, and then he fell automatically in with a group of people crossing the street at the crosswalk zone. Arrested for no real reason, he thought. No purpose. And then they let me go the same way. They had not told him anything, had simply given him back his sack of clothes, wallet, watch, glasses, personal articles, and turned to their next business, an elderly drunk brought in off the street. Miracle, he thought, that they let me go. Fluke of some kind. By rights, I should be on a plane heading for Germany for extermination. He could still not believe it. Either part, the arrest and now this. Unreal. He wandered along past the closed-up shops, stepping over debris blown by the wind. New life, he thought. Like being reborn. Like hell. Is. Who do I thank? Pray, maybe? Pray to what? I wish I understood, he said to himself as he moved along the busy evening sidewalk, by the neon signs, the blaring bar doorways of Grant Avenue. I want to comprehend. I have to. But he knew he never would. Just be glad, he thought, and keep moving. A bit of his mind declared, and then back to Ed. I have to find my way back to the workshop, down there in that basement, pick up where I left off, making the jewelry, using my hands, working and not thinking, not looking up or trying to understand. I must keep busy. I must turn the pieces out. Block by block, he hurried through the darkening city, struggling to get back as soon as possible to the fixed, comprehensible place he had been. When he got there, he found Ed McCarthy seated at the bench, eating his dinner. Two sandwiches, a thermos of tea, a banana, several cookies. Frank Frink stood in the doorway, gasping. At last Ed heard him and turned around. "I had the impression you were dead," he said. He chewed, swallowed rhythmically, took another bite. By the bench, Ed had their little electric heater going. Frank went over to it and crouched down, warming his hands. "Good to see you back," Ed said. He banged Frank twice on the back, then returned to his sandwich. He said nothing more. The only sounds were the whir of the heater fan and Ed's chewing. Laying his coat over a chair, Frank collected a handful of half-completed silver segments and carried them to the arbor. He screwed a wool buffing wheel onto the spindle, started up the motor. He dressed the wheel with bobbing compound, put on the mask to protect his eyes, and then, seated on a stool, began removing the fire scale from the segments, one by one.